Now we'll start Unit 3. And Unit 3 is all about metabolism. The opening chapter for this unit is a generalized chapter about metabolism in general. It's an introduction to metabolism. And then we'll have more specific chapters from the second and third. But the first slide of this introductory chapter is a generalized schematic representation of what we call a biochemical pathway. As you can see, a pathway is made up of some number greater than one, some multiple number of reactions. So a pathway is not a single reaction. It's multiple reactions, not necessarily three like you see here, but some number. And it's not just multiple reactions, it's arranged in such a way that the product of reaction one, whatever that is, which is represented by B, A gets turned into B, that product of reaction one is then a reactant in reaction two. So reaction one feeds reaction two, which then feeds reaction three for however many overall reactions. And therefore, however long the pathway is, you can talk about an original input, the starting molecule here represented by A, and then an ultimate product. There's a product for each individual reaction, but then it is just the reactant in the next reaction until you get to the ultimate product represented by D. And this is how most reactions occur in biochemistry, in organisms, as part of metabolism. What I mean is that most reactions are not just an isolated single reaction. They are part of a pathway. And we'll be studying some specific pathways in the second and third chapters of the unit, but this is an introduction to that. Now, an important thing to recognize about this, and this shouldn't surprise you based on what I've already told you, is that however many reactions there are in a pathway, each individual reaction is catalyzed, for one thing. So it's not an uncatalyzed reaction, it's a catalyzed reaction, which is why you see an enzyme. And more specifically, each individual reaction in a pathway is catalyzed by its own enzyme. Enzyme 1 is not the same as enzyme 2 and 3. Recall what an enzyme is, first of all. What is an enzyme? Right. It is a protein that is operating as a catalyst. Catalysts don't have to be proteins, but in biology, almost all catalysts are proteins, and we call those proteins that act as catalysts enzymes. What is a catalyst, though, more generally?
Something that speeds up a reaction millions of times sometimes.
That's right. A catalyst drastically speeds up a reaction.
Being involved, or is involved in the reaction, but isn't being changed in the reaction.
That's right. And another way of saying that it doesn't get changed is to say that a catalyst, even though it's involved in the reaction, is not a reactant in that reaction, and therefore doesn't get turned into product. And also, relatedly, a catalyst does not have to be involved in a reaction. A reaction can proceed without the help of a catalyst, because it's not a reactant, but that reaction won't occur nearly as quickly. And an important part of this slide is that virtually all of the chemical reactions that occur in organisms are catalyzed reactions, because if you did not speed up those reactions, they wouldn't happen in time for the organism to remain alive. This is why a big fraction of your genes library, your genetic library, a big fraction of the number of genes you have, which corresponds to the number of proteins that you're able to produce, are dedicated to telling the cell how to build your many, many different kinds of enzymes. So what I'm trying to say here is that each individual kind of reaction has its own enzyme. Enzymes are highly specific. They work only for that kind of reaction. In other words, there is not one master enzyme, one versatile protein that can speed up any kind of reaction. That would be like a master key in an apartment complex that will open any door, for instance. You wouldn't want that. It might seem like that would be an ideal situation, but actually that would be a bad situation. Why would a cell not want one master enzyme that can speed up everything?
Wouldn't it just like take apart the things it already has to make something else? It's like just complete random. This goes that goes that. Like just taking apart everything, spilling out random stuff everywhere.
That's right. In other words, if you had one master enzyme, all possible reactions would always be occurring. And a cell does not want that to happen for multiple different reasons. For one thing, you only want to be running reactions that are appropriate for the moment. Running other reactions would be wasteful for one thing, if not fatal. There are several reactions that occur in cells that are opposites of each other. If you have them both turned on, which is effectively what you do when you have an enzyme working, because the reactions are so slow without the enzyme that they're just basically turned off. But if you have opposite working reactions and they're both turned on by the same enzyme, you'd be working against yourself, right? So not only are enzymes important because they drastically speed up reactions and allow them to happen in time for cells to remain alive and therefore organisms to live, but also because the reactions are so slow without the enzymes that they're effectively off, enzymes provide cells a way to control individual reactions. And since most reactions are arranged in pathways, that means controlling enzymes can allow cells to control entire pathways. Pathways can be turned on or off depending on whether that pathway should be run at the time or not, depending on circumstances. Oh, one other thing I want to say before we leave this is that clearly these are enzymes because they're labeled enzymes, but it's important when you indicate an enzyme in a reaction that it's not on one end of the arrow. Those are for reactants or products, right? Reactants go on one side of the arrow, products go on the other side. Enzymes aren't reactants or products. Since they don't get turned into anything, they're reusable. And so an enzyme, if it's put into a schematic like this, should always go above or below the arrow to indicate that it's helping, but it's not a reactant or product. All right, now on the slide two, we need to start talking about energy. We're talking about energy for this whole unit. And energy is a kind of a difficult concept to think about. A lot of textbooks define energy as the capacity to do some sort of work. And that's true. Energy is the capacity to do work. There are many different forms of energy, like chemical energy, light energy, and so on. But there are two major categories of energy based on whether the energy is being used at the moment or not. And those two categories are potential energy and kinetic energy. Now, where the hell are they? Oh, there they are. Potential as a word, just an everyday word, is kind of like capacity, meaning there's a possibility there, right? And so potential energy is often defined in textbooks as stored energy, meaning that potential energy is energy, but it's not at the moment being used for work. It can be put to use, but at the moment it's not being used. Kinetic, on the other hand, has the same root, even though it's spelled with a K instead of a C. It's the same root as in cinema, which means moving pictures. Kinetic energy is energy of motion. In other words, energy that is being used at the moment. Kinetic art, for instance, is art that moves like a mobile, rather than just being a painting on the wall, for instance. So these are the major categories. And importantly, as indicated by this picture, hopefully, energy can be readily moved back and forth between these two categories. In other words, kinetic energy can be converted to potential energy. Potential energy can be converted to kinetic energy. That happens all the time. So we have a diving platform here. And, of course, it's higher than the surface. And gravity, of course, is always working to bring objects toward the surface. So, you can't get up to this platform for free. You have to work in order to get up there by climbing the stairs. Well, when you do that, you are transforming kinetic energy. You're using energy, converting kinetic energy into gravitational potential energy. You're creating a gradient, really, when you go up to the top of the platform, because you are now farther from the surface. You're more you have the potential now to fall because of gravity. All right? And if you do that intentionally or unintentionally, when you fall, your body starts moving. So that is reconversion of potential energy into kinetic energy, the motion of your body. So there's always a conversion between these two major categories. Slide 3 continues this energy discussion. But specifically, we need to talk about laws of thermodynamics, which is a major field of several sciences. Chemistry, physics, and biology all deal with thermodynamics. But thermodynamics as a field of study has to do with energy transactions. And we can see two laws being listed here, A and B, but there are more than two laws of thermodynamics. This is a little bit silly and confusing. We're only going to talk about two laws in here, and they're called the first and second, and so it would be reasonable to assume, well, those are the first two laws, but really they're not. Even though we're not going to talk about the other two are not the third and fourth. That's because the first and second were already laid down as laws, and then they realized, oh, there's actually something more basic we need. But they didn't want to renumber them because they already existed. So the four laws are the zeroth law, the first law, the second law, and the third law. Zeroth and third we're not going to talk about in this course because it's not so much applicable to biology. But what we call the first law of thermodynamics is also known as the law of conservation of energy. And that conservation word, to conserve, means to save, right? Law of conservation of energy means that energy can't be created, it can't be destroyed. In other words, in the universe, which is everything, there is some amount of energy that doesn't change. That's not the only thing the law says, though. Energy can't be created, it can't be destroyed. But it can and readily does get transferred and transformed. Those are two different things. Transferring energy means moving the energy from one body to another. And here, body doesn't have anything to do with biology. Body just means object in the universe. A familiar example is breaking a rack of pool balls. Right? You're transferring that energy of motion from the cue ball to the first ball in the rack. That's a transference of energy. Transformation of energy refers to changing the form of the energy, changing it from one form to another. For instance, this predator eating this prey is taking in chemical energy. The body of the prey animal that's now dead is made up of molecules, of course, organic molecules that we've been talking about. Well, there's a lot of energy, chemical energy, locked up in the bonds between the atoms forming those molecules. That's chemical energy. And so that's what we always take in as food. I mean, that chemical energy, the energy that we get from our food, is chemical energy in the form of bonds between atoms. And that energy can be transformed various ways and used as well. So that's the first law. The second law has to do with a concept called entropy. Which more or less is synonymous with disorder. Entropy is disorder, roughly speaking. And one thing that the second law of thermodynamics tells us is that the entropy of the universe is continuously increasing. In other words, the universe is becoming more and more disordered. Now, if you think back to the very first slide I gave you on day one, I think it was the opening slide, we looked at seven major things that living organisms have in common. One of which was a high degree of order. Right? That flower picture was an example. That's true. Organisms are highly ordered. In other words, they have low entropy. That doesn't violate the second law of thermodynamics. Because in order to increase the order that to create that organism, the rest of the universe has to become even more disordered than the amount of order you're creating in the organism. And so when you account for it all, it's still an increase overall in the universe of disorder or entropy. Another important thing, though, about the second law is that it states that in any thermodynamic transaction, an energy transaction, there is never 100% efficiency. What that means is that there's no such thing as a 100% efficient thermodynamic process. Means that it's never the case that all of the potential energy that's available gets used for actual work. In any given energy transaction, some of the available energy gets lost as heat, which is energy that's not doing work for you. Now, a perfect example of this is an internal combustion engine in a car or a truck, for instance. There's a lot of chemical energy in the fuel. The fuel is really just a mixture of different alkanes that we talked about, hydrocarbons, right? There's a lot of chemical energy locked up in those carbon-hydrogen bonds, which is why gasoline is such a rich fuel. And that's also why our fuels in biology contain those carbon-hydrogen bonds. Monosaccharides, for instance, are the major fuels. But anyway, in an internal combustion engine, not even close to 100% of that energy gets put into propelling the vehicle down the road. A lot of it goes into creating noise and heat. So much heat, as a matter of fact, that if the engine does not have a dedicated cooling system, it's not going to run very long. It's going to just seize up because it gets so hot. So actually, most of the energy gets wasted in that process. But no matter what the process is, including all the biological processes that we're going to talk about in this unit, some of the energy gets wasted as heat. All right, those are the two laws we care about in this course. Now we'll go to four and talk more about energy. So there's several definitions I need to give you on this slide. I've already given you some. I need to define free energy. But actually, before I even define that, I need to define thermodynamic systems for you. All right? I've mentioned thermodynamics as a science, but we have a thermodynamic system is a specific thing, although it can be just about anything you want, as long as you define it. So you have the entire universe, right? That's everything. A thermodynamic system is just some subset of the universe. It can be a chemical reaction. It can be this room. It can be an organism. It can be anything you want as long as you say what it is. But when you do say what it is, that defines not only the system itself, but defining that system breaks the universe into two subsets, non-overlapping subsets. The system itself and everything else. And everything else, the other subset, is collectively called the surroundings. Okay? So, the universe consists of the thermodynamic system, whatever it is, and the surroundings. We have three systems here defined to show you something important about what's happening with the energy. So this free energy is really potential energy. Potential energy in a thermodynamic system. Free energy is symbolized as G. Doesn't seem to make sense, but really free energy is kind of the nickname. The formal name is Gibbs free energy because it's named after Gibbs. That's what the G really stands for, but we just say free energy. Anyway, G, free energy, is an instantaneous value, meaning it's a particular value of the free energy in a system at a particular point in time, at the moment. Each of these systems that are used as examples here are shown in a before state at the top and an after state. So before, after. Each of them individually features a value of G, the before and the after. And as we've already talked about for the osmosis lab, we can use delta notation in science, right? To indicate a change. So delta G is not the same thing as G. G is the value of the free energy in the system at that point in time. To calculate delta G, you have to be talking about two different points in time, right? Before and after. And just like we defined it in the potato lab, there's only one proper way to compute the difference, even though mathematically there's two possibilities, right? There's one proper way, though, for delta notation. It's the final value minus the initial. So delta G is G final, or G sub F, minus G initial, G sub I. Not the other way around. That's important because if there's a change in a thermodynamic system so that the free energy goes down, meaning that the final value is lower than the initial value, right? If it goes down, then that means by this definition you have lower minus greater, right? Which is going to make delta G negative. That's a really important thing. Not the value is important as well. How much it goes down or up is important, but just the sign of delta G is important. And if delta G for a system is negative, or for a process, let me say, because a process is, the system doesn't have to be doing anything, but a process, something is happening, right? If you have a negative delta G for a process, that means energy, free energy, has gone down. Well, you already know from the first law that energy doesn't get destroyed, so that free energy is not lost. I mean, it's not destroyed, but it's no longer part of the system. It's released from the system or from the process. All right? And that's true for each of these three example processes. This first one is the one we already looked at in photographic form, the diving platform. So there's a higher G first. And by the way, high value of G, comparatively speaking, corresponds to instability. The higher G is, the more unstable the system is. Lower G corresponds to more stability. And systems tend to go to lower G values to become more stable, if it's possible. Which is why you can try this as many times as you want. You walk off this platform, you're never going to fall up. That would increase the G, make it even more unstable. When you reach the surface, that's a lot more stable. You're unlikely to fall off the surface. The middle example is a concentration gradient. Because in this sphere, this volume that contains the purple particles, they are not spread out at first, right? They are concentrated. That is an unstable situation because of what I explained in the lab for them moving, and they're going to move in the direction that they can move, which is outward from the crowd. So this system becomes more stable when diffusion occurs. The G value has gone down, and the delta G for this process is negative. And the third example is a large complex molecule being broken apart into several smaller, less complex molecules. Well, a large complex molecule is more of an unstable situation as well. This has to do with what we call degrees of freedom. This large complex molecule can move around in space, right, as an entire molecule. But because of how it's arranged, the constituent atoms that make up that molecule are held in place with respect to the molecule. So wherever the molecule twists, all the atoms have to go. They have to follow, right? When you break it apart into several chunks, each individual chunk has its own freedom to move around. And so this is a more free, in terms of degrees of freedom, this is a more stable situation on the bottom. But once again, this is a delta G that's negative. Okay, now, I need to define three different pairs of antonyms. Antonyms are opposites of each other, like on, off, right? Okay, now one pair is spontaneous and non-spontaneous, the opposite. Spontaneous in chemistry means a specific thing. A spontaneous process is one that can occur on its own. And the reason that it can occur on its own is because the energy required for it to happen is already available in the system. Notice this is almost exactly how I described in the lab originally, diffusion. Remember I said that passive transport, which is what diffusion is not something that doesn't require energy. It requires energy, but the energy is already there. That's exactly what this middle example is. Diffusion is passive. It's a spontaneous process. The energy is the G. It's high at first, it goes lower. That energy is put into allowing the diffusion to happen. It's very important, though, to realize that even though spontaneous means that the process can happen on its own, it doesn't at all mean that it will happen anytime soon. Just that it's able to. And this really goes back to what I was already saying about enzymes. There's a bunch of processes in a bunch of chemical reactions that are part of metabolism in cells that are spontaneous. But that doesn't mean they're going to happen anytime soon or soon enough to remain alive, which is why they need to be catalyzed, even if they're spontaneous. A non-spontaneous reaction, process, on the other hand, will never happen on its own. But that doesn't mean it's impossible for it to happen. It's just that you have to force it to happen. Now, I mentioned the importance of the sign, the mathematical sign, positive or negative, of delta G earlier. This is an indication of spontaneity. A negative delta G value means that the process is spontaneous. Positive delta G, non-spontaneous, and you would have to force that to happen. Well, all of these example processes are shown as happening from top to bottom, according to the arrow. But you can imagine each of them in reverse, from bottom to top. All of those would be non-spontaneous in that direction. You're not going to fall uphill. You have to force that to happen, right? By expending energy from outside the system to climb the stairs. To collect these spheres into a concentrated area, you'd have to force that to happen by active transport, for instance, right? And similarly with building this big molecule out of the small ones. All of those upward processes in these examples would be non-spontaneous. So that's one pair of antonyms. I said there's three pairs, and they go hand in hand, but they describe different things about the system or the process. Let me give you the second pair. Second pair is anabolic and catabolic. Now, do you remember what I said the definition of metabolism is? What is metabolism? No idea, or you just don't want to say?
Is it a set of sequential catabolic reactions?
Not necessarily. Metabolism is the sum of all chemical reactions occurring in an individual organism, whether it's one cell or many cells. Okay, so metabolism is life, really, because life is just the chemistry that's happening in cells. But metabolism is all of the chemical reactions, so that's a huge set. That's an exhaustive list of all the reactions. There's two subsets of that, though, non-overlapping. So any given reaction is one or the other. The two halves of metabolism are anabolism and catabolism. These are just the adjectives of those. All right. Anabolic means building bigger things out of smaller things. Like if you were to run this third example in reverse, uphill here. Catabolic is just the opposite. Look, I said these are antonyms. Catabolic refers to splitting bigger, more complex things into smaller, less complex things. So there are anabolic reactions and there are catabolic reactions, and all those reactions collectively are metabolic reactions. Notice that these words differ only in the prefix an and cat, which you see in other kinds of words.
I was going to say ions earlier, cations.
Yes, anions and cations. And also, in electricity, we have an anode and a cathode. And you can categorize certain fish that, when it comes time to spawn, they swim to a different place. There are anadromous fish and catadromous fish. Cat means down, like in catheter, same prefix, because it lets down a fluid. An means up. So anabolic, you're building things up. Anabolic steroids are drugs that allow you to build up your body. Catabolic, you're breaking things down. All right? The third pair of antonyms has to do with what happens to energy. And those are endergonic and exergonic. And notice the similarity. Ergon here is in both these words. Ergon means energy. There's actually a unit called the erg. But ergon means energy. And endo means in or inward. Exo means out or outward. So linguistically, endergonic means taking in energy. And exergonic linguistically means releasing energy. Energy comes out in the process. I really should have listed this first as non-spontaneous and spontaneous so that they correspond better. Because even though these three sets of antonyms describe different things about the process, they correspond to each other. So if you're trying to describe what happens to the energy, then you would choose endergonic or exergonic. If you're trying to describe whether something's being built up or tore down, you would use anabolic or catabolic. And if you're trying to describe whether or not something is possible to happen on its own, you would use non-spontaneous or spontaneous. But a spontaneous process corresponds to a catabolic process. Catabolism, breaking things into smaller pieces, releases energy, so it corresponds to exergonic also. And that can occur on its own. Big things naturally will break into smaller chunks because that's a spontaneous process, even though it might not happen very soon. Right? The other three correspond to each other as well. Non-spontaneous corresponds to anabolic, which corresponds to endergonic. Non-spontaneous processes are non-spontaneous because you have to put energy in the system in order to force them to happen. And putting the energy in means they're endergonic. All right, so that's the correspondence of all these various terms. Let's go on to 5 now. Look at a couple graphs. These graphs are different, obviously, but they're set up, as far as the axes are concerned, the same way. In other words, both of them plots free energy versus progress of the reaction. And progress of the reaction is really just another way of saying time, right? Before and after. Before the reaction occurs and after it does. But the y-axis is g. Any given point, any height, is a particular value of g. So there's a g before and there's a g after for both of these reactions. Each one of these is a reaction. Each one of these graphs is a reaction. Delta g, therefore, which is, as I've shown you on the board, g final minus g initial, is this value of g minus this value of g. So for the top, the red graph, notice that the final value of g is smaller than the initial value of g, therefore small minus big equals negative delta g. Graphically, the delta g is represented by the distance between the two bars in the graph, because those are the two values of g. But since you end up with less g, that's a negative delta g, and by definition, that is an exergonic reaction. Corresponds to a spontaneous process. Exactly the opposite for the blue one, though. In this process, you start out with a lower value of g, you end up with a greater value of g. Well, you're going to have to supply that energy if there's any hope for it to happen. So this would correspond to a non-spontaneous reaction. Non-spontaneous reactions happen all the time, though, and they're an important part of biology. It's just that they have to be forced to happen because that energy has to come from outside of the system. And that's what the exo part of exergonic refers to. Okay. Now to six. I defined generally what a thermodynamic system is, which is basically anything you want as long as you define it, as I said, some set of the subset of the universe. But there are three categories of thermodynamic systems, meaning any given thermodynamic system is one or the other category. There's three possible categories, though. And those categories are open system, open thermodynamic system, but it's easier just to say open system, closed. And you might think, well, that has to be everything. If something's either open or closed, but there's another category, which is isolated. Here's the difference. An open system is one for which both mass, matter, that is, matter and energy can be exchanged with the surroundings. So matter can go in or out, energy can go in or out. Closed is not entirely closed. What we call a closed thermodynamic system is one for which energy can be exchanged with the surroundings, but matter cannot. And isolated is what you would think of as fully closed. An isolated system can't exchange energy or matter with the surroundings. In other words, a truly isolated thermodynamic system is cut off from the rest of the universe. And that's why there's really no such thing. It's just a concept. It's important in the study of thermodynamics, but there's no real truly isolated thermodynamic system, which is why the book is wrong here using the word isolated here. But that's what an isolated system is. It's really just a concept. Now, we can design things to be as close to isolated as possible, and that's exactly what a Dewar flask is, or a thermos bottle, for instance. It's closed because no matter is getting in or out. But it's not truly isolated because even though we minimize by the design the transfer of energy with the surroundings, if you wait long enough, of course, your either cold or hot liquid is going to come to room temperature eventually, right? But anyway, that's the difference between closed and isolated. So this is wrong here. This is not, how do you know just from the picture that this is not an isolated hydroelectric system but a closed one? What is it that makes it not isolated? What is it? Yes, but how do you know from the picture itself that it's isolated?
That
it's not isolated, sorry.
Well, because it's got like, it's spinning the turbine there, right?
Yes.
That's why it was turning on the light bulb, so the energy is flowing out.
The light bulb itself is why you know it isn't. The light is going out of the system. Light is energy. Right? So no matter is going into or out of this system. It's closed. But the fact that you can see the light from the surroundings means that energy is leaving the system. Okay? But the water is the important matter here, right? And you have two tanks with different water levels to begin with. So in other words, just like for the diver earlier, there is a potential gradient, a gravitational gradient here. And always remember what I told you I would be repeating many times, namely that any given gradient is a form of potential energy. And therefore, if it's set up properly, it can do some work. Here, water wants to go down its gradient gravitationally. It wants to fall. And the only way it's able to do that is to go to the different tank through this tunnel that forces the water to turn the turbine. And that generates electricity. That's why the light lights. That's the work that's being done. But since it's a closed system, eventually this is going to come to equilibrium, right? It'll come to equilibrium when there is no more gravitational gradient. Specifically, when the water levels in the two chambers equal each other. Then there's no more tendency for water to go from one vat to the other. Stops the spinning, the light goes out. All right, now the second one in B is an open system. Exactly the same, except that you have an inlet for water and an outlet for water. And if you continuously put in the same amount of water as is flowing outward, that will maintain the gradient. And therefore, water will continue to spin the turbine. The light will continue to burn. Now, we're not studying hydroelectric systems just for their own sake in this chapter. They're here by analogy. Which one of these is more like an organism? The closed or the open system?
The open.
The open. Yes, much more like an organism. In fact, no living organism can ever be a closed thermodynamic system. All organisms are open systems because to remain alive requires the organism to more or less continuously exchange both matter and energy with the surroundings. And that, by definition, makes you an open thermodynamic system. So B is much better than A if you want to think of it in organism terms, but C is even better. This is a multi-step hydroelectric system. Notice that the overall change in the levels in this multi-step is the same as the overall change when you do it in just one step. So the gradient, the overall gradient, is the same. But instead of using that gradient all in one step, releasing all that energy at once, the multi-step one releases it a little bit at a time, breaks the gradient into smaller gradients. This is more analogous to a real organism because of what we're going to study in the next chapter, actually. This is really how we process our fuels. We don't release all of that potential chemical energy from our fuels all at once. That would kill us because it would be too much heat released. But it would also not give us a chance to harness that energy to use it effectively. Just like if you didn't have the turbine here, you would be doing nothing but just allowing water to spill downhill, right? It wouldn't be doing any work. Well, as we'll see, when we burn our fuels, we don't do it all in one shot, like putting a match to the fuel. We release a little bit of energy at a time in manageable amounts that will keep us alive, keep us from exploding, basically, and also allow us to capture that energy so that a lot of it, or less of it, will be wasted as heat and more of it can be devoted to actually doing cellular work. 7. Along those lines, this is a really important molecule that we're looking at here. What is this? What is this molecule overall? It is a nucleotide. Thanks. That was actually going to be my next question. Specifically, this is ATP, which is a acronym for adenosine triphosphate. But I'm glad you anticipated my question and said that it's a nucleotide. The reason I asked you, even though it's not labeled, what this overall molecule is because we've looked at it before in a different chapter. When were nucleotides discussed? What do you know a nucleotide as?
DNA.
For example, not necessarily DNA
or RNA.
Both of which are nucleic acids, right? Nucleic acids are polymers, if you have a big nucleic acid, it's a polymer, right? Polymers are made out of small subunits. What are the subunits called? They're called nucleotides. Right, which is why one long string of them, a polymer, yes, you can call it a nucleic acid, but really, it's more descriptive to call it a polynucleotide. Remember we used that word? Like each strand of a double-stranded DNA is its own polynucleotide because it's an end-to-end arrangement of nucleotides. So that's a really important job of nucleotides, including this one. This specific one is ATP, but there are other versions. Do you remember why there are different versions of nucleotides? Well, one reason is that the choice of sugar is one reason why you have. This pink one here is ribose. You use ribose in nucleotides to construct RNA. If this were deoxyribose instead, by not having this oxygen here, then this would be a nucleotide used for DNA. Right? But the other reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides is because any given nucleotide has two things attached to its sugar, a nitrogenous base and some number of phosphates. The phosphates are all the same. No phosphate is different from any other phosphate. But this nitrogenous base doesn't have to be this particular one, which is adenine. Remember, there's other choices. So this particular nucleotide, which is adenosine triphosphate, is already important as a nucleotide that can be a building block to build an RNA polynucleotide. This is an entirely different job that this same molecule is important for that we're studying now. And that other important job, which itself is vital, is to serve as an energy-carrying molecule. Now, before we get more into that, let me ask you whether you remember when we first talked about nucleotides and the fact that a nucleotide has three parts to it. Do you remember what I said we would call a nucleotide, that has no phosphate connected to it? In other words, just the sugar and the nitrogenous base together. What is that called? Anyone remember? That's called a nucleoside, with an S instead of a T. And this particular nucleoside, when it's ribose for the sugar, ribose as the sugar and adenine specifically as the nitrogenous base. In other words, if you just have these two, none of the yellow, then that particular nucleoside would be called adenosine, named for adenine. The reason I'm going through all of this name stuff is because the word nucleotide is ambiguous. It doesn't tell you the whole story. To be a nucleotide, you have to have the sugar, a nitrogenous base, and some positive number of phosphates. But the word nucleotide doesn't tell you how many phosphates. Right? That's why it's more descriptive, even though it is true to say that ATP is a nucleotide, it's more descriptive to say that it is a nucleoside triphosphate. Because the word triphosphate tells you there are exactly three phosphates, not just some number one or greater. And the reason that's so important to the current unit is because when it comes to the job of ATP as an energy-carrying molecule, it is carrying energy in the form of bonds between the phosphates. Okay, phosphate-phosphate bonds holding these together is chemical potential energy that this molecule is carrying. And as we'll see, when that energy is tapped, in other words, when you use an ATP molecule to do something, some sort of work in the cell, what you're really doing is breaking a phosphate-phosphate bond. And that's going to turn a nucleoside triphosphate into a nucleoside diphosphate. Because it's only going to have two phosphates hooked to it when you break this terminal bond. And so ATP is important, but it's just one of the nucleoside phosphates that the body or any cell uses. There's different forms. We can see ATP being used in slide 8 if we follow the arrow here and go from top to bottom. So you have ATP to begin with, adenosine triphosphate, because there's exactly three phosphates. Notice that it's one of the terminal phosphate-phosphate bond is what's being broken here. So you end up with adenosine diphosphate plus now a phosphate that's on its own. So let me remind you that a P by itself does not mean phosphate. Right? A P by itself means a phosphorus atom. A P with a circle around it means a phosphate group. So there's not only the phosphorus atom, there's also four oxygen atoms there. It's just shorthand. But when a phosphate group, which has been removed, is now on its own, why is it called inorganic phosphate, which is what the I subscript refers to? Right, a phosphate group by itself doesn't ever have carbon, right? It's just phosphorus and oxygen. But when it's on its own, it's not connected to anything that has carbon. These phosphates are organic because they're part of an overall organic molecule. Each one of these corners in the schematic in the nucleoside is a carbon atom. Okay? And so there's in any given cell, there is a pool of phosphate, inorganic phosphate. But at any given moment, they can be now part of an organic molecule. So phosphates are being moved around all the time. Now, what specific kind of reaction is this if you turn adenosine triphosphate into adenosine diphosphate and inorganic phosphate? What kind of reaction is being shown here based on what you've already learned?
Does he say, wait, so you're adding the water to this?
Water is required, right.
Well, hydration, right?
Not hydration, hydrolysis. The lysis part of the word refers to splitting, right? You're splitting a bigger molecule into smaller ones. Remember, water is required because something's going to get H, something's going to get OH. So this is hydrolysis if you go from top to bottom. Hydrolysis is splitting of an ATP, and that's what uses the ATP because it releases the chemical energy that was locked up in the bond between the two phosphates at the end. So, in terms of today's definitions that you've learned, how would you describe this using an ATP in terms of what happens to energy? That's not a choice for what happens with energy. Right. So it would be an exergonic reaction because you're releasing energy. It is true that it would be considered catabolic, but that's for a different reason. It's catabolic because you're breaking a bigger thing into smaller things. And what about spontaneity?
Yes, because it's just adding water, but not adding energy to this, right?
Yes, it is spontaneous.
Yeah.
Yes, it's spontaneous because, even though they're not listed here, if you were to look at the delta G, when you go from ATP to ADP, it's a release of G. It's a decrease in G, so therefore a negative delta G. Spontaneous. Okay. It's shown happening in that direction, and that is important. This is how cells use ATP. But this is a reversible reaction. All of the other antonyms are going to apply, though, right? If you go uphill. In other words, you can hook a phosphate onto an ADP to turn it back into an ATP. That would be anabolic. It would be non-spontaneous. It would be endergonic. And what kind of reaction would it be instead of hydrolysis?
Dehydration,
exactly. And this is what I meant a little bit earlier when I said ATP is just one version of our nucleoside pool. You have, first of all, many, many quadrillions of these things in your body. Some in the form of ATP, some in the form of ADP. And actually, ADP can undergo a hydrolysis as well if you take off another phosphate, and that would be called adenosine monophosphate because there's only one phosphate at that point. So you really have a pool of all three, ATP, ADP, and AMP, and they're going back and forth between each other depending on whether you're forcing more energy into them to store the energy or you're breaking them apart to release the energy. Okay? In slide 9, we're looking at just one example reaction that uses ATP. So it's not really the specific reaction that matters here, but the important point here is that in any given cell, there are all kinds of endergonic reactions that have to take place, or even more generally, endergonic processes, but this is a reaction. Endergonic reactions have to happen because they're necessary for life. None of them is going to happen on their own, though, right? Because endergonic reactions are non-spontaneous. Still required, though. So you have to force them to happen. And you can force them to happen by linking them, or coupling them, I should say, with exergonic reactions. With the help of ATP, usually. And that's what's shown here. So you have an endergonic reaction here, which is involving two reactants, glutamic acid, which is a type of amino acid, and ammonia. When you hook those two together, you make glutamine. Okay? Notice what the delta G is, though. It's a positive number. That indicates that it's not going to happen, right? The cell needs glutamine, though, so you have to run this reaction. You have to force it to happen. All right, well, here's how you can. Right below that, you have glutamic acid again and ATP. ATP is nucleoside triphosphate, has three phosphates. if you allow those to react, you split the ATP to get one of the phosphates off of it, which gets stuck onto glutamic acid, making a phosphorylated glutamic acid. Just like the phosphate gave the ATP more energy, this glutamic acid is kind of an activated version of glutamic acid because of its phosphate. It has a higher G value. All right. Then, if you have the already phosphorylated glutamic acid and you react it with ammonia, then the phosphate gets displaced by the ammonia easily, forming glutamine, which is your goal. But when you do it with a phosphorylated glutamic acid, it's going to happen readily. All right? The balance sheet is at the bottom. So you have a positive delta G for the part of this process that actually forms glutamine out of glutamic acid and ammonia. That's what you're trying to accomplish. It's a delta G of a positive number, though. The hydrolysis of ATP, which is what you're coupling it with, is the exergonic reaction because it has a negative delta G value. And when they're coupled, happening together, you're really defining a new system, which is both of them together. And for that new system, the overall delta G is the sum of the two delta Gs for the things that are being coupled. And notice when you add positive 3.4 to negative 3.7, you get negative 3.9. So as a coupled system, this thing is overall exergonic and therefore spontaneous. It will happen. All right. Now, what would happen if instead of being positive 3.4 for the production of glutamine, what if this were positive 7.3? In other words, exactly the amount of energy that's released from the hydrolysis of ATP. What would happen? Would just exactly enough energy allow this to happen? Well, in a sense, but why is the answer no? Why is the world imperfect?
Because
not really because of isolation.
Because there's no perfect efficiency.
Right, because of the second law of thermodynamics. You're always going to lose some energy as heat wasted. So exactly enough is not enough. Notice you have more than enough, though. ATP is releasing more than you need. So even with the heat waste, there's still enough to make this happen. Okay, good. Now let's define couple major categories of cellular work that ATP can perform. Actually, even before we get into this, I need to talk a little bit more about ATP in general. So we're not quite to slide 10 yet. ATP, I've already described as an energy carrier. It temporarily stores energy in the form of phosphate-phosphate bonds. Textbooks, just about any textbook you pick up for biology, will describe ATP as the energy currency of the cell. By analogy with money, right? Currency. And that's a good analogy. So let's think about what money is, which money by itself is fairly worthless. Money is really just a representative, or it's a storage device in a sense. Nowadays, effectively no one works at whatever job he or she has directly for the things that person needs. You don't work directly for housing or for food or whatever. Right? Instead, you work directly for money. And that money represents your effort. In a sense, it is storing the energy you put into your work. temporarily. You don't save it forever, right? It's stored for a while, and then you use the money, you spend the money on any of many different kinds of things that you need or want. So money is very versatile. Well, the same is true for ATP. In cells, there are all kinds of endergonic processes that have to be forced to happen for the cell to remain alive. So by definition, you have to supply energy for that. But a cell, well, the source, the ultimate source, the original source of energy for cells to do their various kinds of endergonic processes is from fuel. Fuel molecules contain chemical energy. We burn our fuels just like we burn fuel in a gas tank. And that releases energy, okay? But in a cell, the exergonic processes, the exergonic reactions of burning the fuel to release the energy, is not used directly to power those endergonic processes that are necessary. Just like we don't work directly for our needs. Instead, the energy that's released from fuels, some of it's wasted as heat, of course, but some of that gets captured, stored in the form of ATP molecules that get produced because of that release of energy when we burn our fuels. That's like the money. And just like money is versatile with respect to what you can spend it on, the ATP, which is now storing energy that used to be in the fuel, can be used, that energy can be released, to power a great variety of different endergonic reactions that have to be forced to happen. Now, the money analogy is good, even if you think of it as cash. But it's actually even a better analogy if you think of ATP as a debit card. A debit card can have either a high balance or a low balance, is what I mean here, whereas a cash has a certain value only. So ATP is like a debit card on payday. It's a high balance, a lot of energy available. And you don't have to spend that whole balance. You can make a purchase, turn that into ADP. You still have a positive balance there. And you could, if you needed to, use that ADP, make another purchase. That would turn it into AMP. AMP is like an emergency low balance on the debit card, meaning you need to get back to work, right, to make a deposit. Well, AMP in the body or in a cell is a strong signal saying you're not burning fuel fast enough to keep up with the demand. You're spending more than you're making. All right, so that's, think of it in that terms, in those terms. But let me just, in the minute I have left, say that ATP is used for a great variety of things, but there are two major categories of cellular work that can be performed using ATP, which is so-called transport work, but really the better phrase here is transmembrane transport. It's not just moving things, which is what transport means. It's specifically moving things through a membrane. And that can happen, remember, for free. Or it can happen passively. That wouldn't require ATP. So what we're talking about by transmembrane transport work is moving things against their gradient to produce a gradient. Pumps, in other words. And then the other major category on the bottom is mechanical work, moving things around within the cell. This involves the motor proteins that I was talking about. Every single step of a motor protein requires a fresh ATP molecule turned into an ADP in order to, for that step to occur. All right, so spending the ATP allows the work to happen, but you end up with a lower balance, ADP and inorganic phosphate. No problem, though, because you can recombine these back into ATP if you burn more fuel to provide the energy to do that. So that's where we'll start next time.